come to see you. I haven't seen you in a while.
It's good to be here.
Thank you.
So with palms pressed together or palms upwards in order to receive, let's say the Sufi invocation together.
Toward with the woman, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls, and form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance.
And now palms upward, let there be the sense of streaming blessings from above, filling your cupped hands with beautiful, revivifying, healing, purifying golden light, and take this cup of light and offer it over your whole auric field, filling it with the peace and blessings of God, who is manifest in the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. So today, our subject is unlearning. What a great subject. Because we do, honestly, spend a lot of time learning, accomplishing, acquiring knowledge, becoming professionals, etc., etc. And it's all very good, we'll learn. But at the same time, it can be a hindrance. So for Linda's benefit, this is a body of teachings from an Indian master who was a master teacher, a master musician, and a master philosopher and poet. And his name is Anayat Khan. We also call him Hazrat Anayat Khan, Hazrat being a beloved person or teacher that has passed. Sometimes I'll use the word Murshid, M-U-R-S-H-I-D. That means most senior teacher, so we refer to him as Murshid also. This paper was delivered, so it was a lecture given by Murshid on September 8th, 1925. But as always, we realize how timeless these teachings are, right? And if they seem rather simple, which sometimes they do, and you think, I know that, it's just a deep resonance of that kind of connectedness or knowing. And yet, knowing is so different than being and doing, right? We know that. So listen to the words, see how they resonate within, and take what you, as His Holiness would always say before the teachings, whatever is benefit to you, take with you. Whatever isn't, forget about it. So again, this is from a collection of lectures called Message Papers. The subject is unlearning. It was delivered on September 8th, 1925. That's a special date for those of us that are Catholic. Isn't that Mary's birthday? I think it is. I think so. It's a special day. And I do want to say for the content of the class, I edited this from a much longer article. When I send out the files, there'll be a link to it, and you can read the whole article in its entirety. So it begins like this. Unlearning is a process by which one rises above what one has learned. Unlearning is a process by which one rises above what one has learned. It does not mean forgetting what one has learned. It only means rising above what one has learned. Now let's just look at that phrase, rising above. Do you have any examples of what of rising above? Like, where are we, or what are our experiences? Like, we're sitting here. We could talk about elevating our consciousness, but in a physical sense, what happens? When we climb a mountaintop and we're looking. Right?
It takes our breath away.
It's so expansive, right? Mm-hmm. Or when we're flying and we look out, it's so all-encompassing, you know, or we're standing at the edge of the sea, it seems infinite. Or we're looking at the night sky, oh my gosh, we just go right up into the stars, or deep blue sky in the day, we just be elevated to that. So this is like, in a way, we could also say it's unconcretizing our thinking. So we open it up. It's like, you know, we can kind of, Murshid also says that shatter your ideal on the rock of truth. So we have to build these ideas, and sometimes we have to shatter them. And in truth, if we look at things from a scientific point of view, that's how all great scientific discovery happens, correct? You have a presumption, you're living under that. But eventually it has to be challenged, and then you test it, and our knowledge evolves. So in the same way, Murshid's asking us to be open to that, to open our view. Does that make sense? A lot of words for those two sentences, but I think it's important to get an idea, a deeper idea of what he's saying. So Murshid goes on to say, learning means fixing ideas and making them material. So those of us that study this tradition know we do the elemental breaths and the purification breaths, whereby we sort of work from the earth up to the spiritual realm, but then conversely, think of it as bringing the spirit to earth. So here he's saying that when we learn, we take these ideas that come to us through spirit, we bring them into the mental realm, we integrate them through our passion and desire to understand them. We bring them in maybe into the emotional body that gives them a substance and sustenance to propel ourselves to do something on the earthly plane. But can we reverse that process? Does that make sense? When an idea is fixed in the mind, it becomes tangible. That knowledge becomes a kind of veil for any other knowledge that can illuminate the path through life. So have you ever, I just don't understand. Mm-hmm. Well, it's because we've made something tangible, we've made it concrete, we've made it materialized, and we almost have put a veil or even a wall before us. And frequently that wall is between us and others. You know, I just don't understand that or this. We may say, I just don't understand them. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a real, you know, that's creating a catalytic experience where you're almost in a paralysis of not understanding. Murshid goes on to say, it's not necessary to forget in order to unlearn. Unlearning is looking at things from an opposite point of view. So one of the things that I've been practicing. In America, at least, we have a very catalyzed, is that the right word? Am I using the right word? There's friction between our political parties and our points of view.
Polarized.
Polarized, that's a good word. Thank you, Radha. So I keep trying to look at the ways I polarize my own thinking, and I say, well, what if I looked at it, I got on the other side and I looked at it from that point of view, you know, and things are neither all good or all bad. There's good and the bad and the good, right? And sometimes those of us that have gone through health challenges know sometimes you have to take a little poison to get well too, right? So we have to look at things from other points of view. We don't have to, but we might be happier and feel freer if we could. I have a lot of people writing to me about the political situation, Sufis, that are very troubled by it. And, you know, stress definitely has a negative effect on our lives. And so, you know, how do I advise some people stop watching the news for a while. And I've known people that have done that are happier. You know, and we even have people that live in other countries that are dealing with polarized situations that have had, you know, they're intellectuals. They want to be involved. They want to, but they know that it is, they do what they can actively. They live their lives well. When they can, they vote. They make those kinds of decisions. But unplugging so it doesn't become all-consuming might be healthy even for a little while. I know some of our friends, Nur Latifa, I know you took your self off Facebook for a while just to kind of get a break from all of it. So those are things that we can do or practice. So Murshid, so I'll read that previous sentence again. It is not necessary to forget in order to unlearn. Unlearning is looking at things from an opposite point of view. In other words, seeing things from another angle as clearly as one is able to see from the angle from which one is used to looking at them. Any examples that anyone can talk about?
Well, I think it comes up even as a designer and working with students that we have ideas about how something should be. But I find myself even in that situation working with students, it's again, how do you look at it from a different angle or a different point of view? What is it that we can do to kind of help just get outside of that fixed way of looking?
In a very literal sense, it's interesting how it can be used even in advertising.
Yeah.
For example, you know, you go by a billboard and all of a sudden it has a letter backwards. You notice it, right? Mm-hmm. It can call your attention. So it's just taking something simple and changing its view to us, and we notice it. So those are things that I know when I was teaching, I'd often look at the work. The students, I'd say, put your work before me, and they'd always put it facing me. I said, no, put it facing you. I want to look at it upside down. Mm-hmm. Because you can always tell where the things are really wrong when you look at it that way. And so we would do that, and then I would turn it around to see if they could see it. So again, in a very, that's more of a, you know, that's a really, that in a way is a tangible experience. But it is something that's, it's useful in learning or unlearning. Unlearning, yeah. So, and I know Joe as a scientist would tell us that our understanding is as only good as our tools that we measure things by. You do, Rada. Engineers, you know that. So we do
a lot of looking not where the keys were dropped, but under the streetlight.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. 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 It's, well, the light's here. Yeah, but you didn't drop them there, you know?
Exactly.
So in other words, to look at things from a different angle and try that. May I ask you just to try it? If you're looking at the news and you're like, about somebody, say, well, what if I was in their shoes? How would I think or feel? And is it all good? Is it all bad?
For example, I'm a Democrat, so you are asking me to look at politics from the Republican side of view.
You could try. See what I mean. You don't have to change your views. It's just open up and look at what they're,
yes,
what makes them feel, you know.
Yes.
And we have people,
yes,
in this room that I know might identify themselves as Republicans. There's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
I love them just the same. I respect their points of view and why they're making those choices. So it's, it doesn't mean I'm right.
If we look back, if we take a step back and you see a problem where someone is down and one side of the political spectrum wants to help the guy up, and the other side of the political spectrum says we need to establish a system where he helps himself up. Both sides want him up.
Yeah.
Both sides want the vitality.
Yeah.
But it's a different way of approaching.
That's
and
right.
If you step back and say, well, we're kind of on the same side because,
yeah,
we both want the guy up.
Hmm.
And I kind of get where you're coming from. So if we make him stronger at the beginning, less likely to fall. But just for that second, get that last little boost up. So everybody wins.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, seeing where the common ground is, and that's what they're talking about, working across the aisle with people. Where do we agree and how can we accomplish this instead of being polarized?
Yes.
So I'm using politics because it's very, very much in our minds right now.
Unfortunately, that's very visceral right now. But it's even in terms of religion. I mean, I know people who are very fundamentalist religion, but probably one of the most stubborn people I know is atheist. He's a fundamentalist militant atheist, so to speak. So it's you know, on all sides, no matter what it is, there's extremes,
mm-hmm,
that you have to be able to look at the other side
and accommodate that and not more fully create friction. You know, it's, people are entitled to that. You know, we don't have to make everybody agree with us.
Yeah, well, I got a box full of things that came from this person that is trying to convince me he's a fundamentalist Christian, okay? And I talk about the Sufism, and he thinks I am worshiping the devil. So he gathered all this information and threw it in this box, okay, with Bible verses. And I think he's a kook, okay? but
there's something to be learned from that, too. I mean, the Sufi studies the Bible.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's like, thank you. And goodbye. You know what I mean?
Yes.
You don't have to carry the conversation on. Just take
them.
There's something to be learned there. We don't know, you know? I mean, I'm the first one. Joe can tell you. We were in Florida not long ago, and I was there are always the Jehovah's Witnesses. I don't know how they do it. They stand in the sun nonstop, all dressed up, polite and quiet, just waiting for someone to come and talk to them. Now, it happens that at the college where Gemma and I have taught, we had several students that were Jehovah's Witnesses. And I will say they had the most wholesome outlook. They seemed, without exception, they seemed quite extraordinarily balanced in their emotions, helpful to others, very considerate and respectful. And, you know, that probably has a lot of things to do with a lot of things. But it seems that that group of people were all Jehovah's Witnesses and very involved in their path. So I always walk up to these people and I'm like, I just want to tell you, you did a great job. I have students and they are just the best people and they contribute so much to the college community and atmosphere. And they're so happy. They don't try to convert me or give me any literature, you know. But I really want to, I mean, I think that when good happens, you acknowledge it. And I was in San Francisco with my sister not long ago. I did the same thing. We're up at the Golden Gate Bridge and they're up there standing just, you know, they really are very dedicated and committed to their path. And So I always want them to know. I my encounters with young people that have come from that tradition are really very special. So, of course, I start a conversation at the time I leave our home and I travel across the country, and I'm still just one stream of conversation with different people. So that's what Joe tells me.
Nuria makes more friends waiting for a plane at the airport than I have.
Yes.
So Merchant goes on to say, once one has unlearned, one sees from two opposite angles everything in life, and it gives one a great mastery. Why would it? Because we're not just single visioned. We have a broader perspective and maybe a desire to learn from what's in the box. Let's think about it. And maybe call him and thank him for that.
Okay.
You know, you never really know. It's good to know. It's good to learn. It's good to ask. Why are you committed? Maybe not in this instance, because maybe you don't want that conversation. But some people, you know, just even without saying what a political point of view or even a religious point of view, it would be interesting to know from others theirs and what inspires them. We can just look at it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And learn.
Even when there's a polarization, it doesn't mean that we're not in agreement on some things.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's looking at that good, you know, we're trying to find the good.
Gemma? I keep sort of feeling too, just my own like physical response in those moments when I've had that when I am polarized or fixed in my thinking, there's this sort of tension and resistance within me. But the minute that something shifts where I'm able to listen or hear something and then see that other side, it almost like creates a balance, you know, in a way. And it's like the body just releases and relaxes, and I'm able to be with a person or a situation, whatever's causing that, in a whole different way. And it like relieves a stress almost.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. Because I think what happens is we constrict, and it's like then this pressure is internal.
The release of the energy that was resisting.
Yeah.
And if you let that go,
Well, it also embraces the circumstance, you know.
Right, and I was just going to say, I think you replace knowledge.
What is that?
That's Chris.
Oh, hi, Raheem. Can you mute your microphone, please?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, just mute it. It's you can do it in the lower left corner of your screen. Thank you.
Hello, Leah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but can you maybe put the volume a little bit higher? I have a very hard time hearing you.
So, Satara, it's hard to hear. Hard to hear?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe you could.
It's hard to hear me or just everyone in the room?
I don't know. For me,
it's... Yeah. We'll all try to speak up.
Thank you.
Susan, could you, or Safira, could you say that again? You were talking about wisdom.
Yeah, I just think that when you try to learn about the other person's position or think about the other person's position, you replace judgment with knowledge. For me.
Well, and I think, you know, we've had this conversation, other circles that I've been in, about this word judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And, judging is one thing, but sort of discriminating wisdom or discernment's another. I mean, I think it's okay to kind of evaluate.
Right.
And in a way, that's what Merchant's saying. Look at things from two different points of view. So I think that, I think judgment, you're really right about that. I think that's a hard word. I mean, who are we to judge others? Judge oneself, but don't judge others. Take oneself to task, as Merchant would say. But looking at things with in Buddhism, they call it the wisdom mind or the wisdom eye, you know. So Mercer goes on to say, so he talks about this as mastery, just being, and you're talking about that too, Gemma, where you're, instead of being small and constricting, you release and you relax and you create an accommodation for another person is another way of saying it. And that's a mastery.
And it's the rising above,
yeah,
like you were talking about.
Well, opening. Mersh, yeah, the opening. That's right. That's right. So Mersh goes on to say, in the spiritual practices of a Sufi, foreign words are often used. This is important. We all know this. Linda, new to the path, doesn't know this so much. And Christine, I think you've been here enough to know that we use these words. And it says, he says, and sometimes I hear this too from people. Why should I say these funny words? Right? So he says, and sometimes a person thinks, why must I repeat a word which is a foreign word, which is a strange word to me? And then he says, if the word suggests something, why must I not use the word which is in my own language? And if people say that, I say, okay, find a word in your language and use it. Like, there's no rule you have to use these words, but this is why we use the words. And then Mershit goes on to explain, they may be right in saying it, but if they could see from the other point of view, and they could only see if they would try to see, or if they try it. You know, someone looks at something, it's like, I'm not going to eat that, I don't like the way that looks. But, you know, as soon as they taste it, it's like, oh, why have I been depriving myself of this wonderful thing my whole life? You know, it's that way, right? It's that judgment. We cut ourselves off and then, you know, we think that it's that way for an ever and ever, amen. So Mershit says that if they would only try and see. He said that's what's called unlearning. In the first place, the great linguist of the day, past, but even now, when studying ancient language, find that the ancient languages which still exist have some psychological and mystical power in their words. So they have a vibration, an ancient vibration. And I've said it before, I'll say it again. You know, Sister Mary Eugene, third grade, she'd say, just think, and she was 6 feet tall, you know, with these big rosary beads, you just watch. But she was also so gentle and so kind. She didn't always show that side, but I saw that side of her. And she would say, just think of it, children. The same breath that Jesus breathed is still exist in the universe. Breathe it in. I mean, what a mystical thought, right? Mm-hmm. Or just think, the same music that's been created by all the great composers still goes on in the universe. Listen, children, listen. You know, those kinds of things, what a beautiful expression. It connects us with the unseen world. But it also connects us with vibration.
Yes.
That's the mysticism of vibration. And everything we know from physics, everything is vibration. Right? So do we are we tuning to the vibration of a steel rod? You know, or are we trying to tune to the vibration of everything and adapt? So think of it that way. So this mystical power of words. And I want to talk about one of these words. And I'll also give an English version. So you choose what you want to do. We're going to say the one version out loud, and the other version, if you wish to repeat it silently in English, just so we don't get a confluence of sounds that could be confusing. But this word is Aleem. Aleem. It's often transliterated or spelled A-L-I-M, but it's pronounced A-L-E-E-M, long E-E. Now, what does this word mean? I wonder, some of you know, I wonder if we should do it and then see what your experience is. Because that's, of course, the way my teacher, Mershita Vira, taught me. I'd have to do the practice. She never gave me the meaning. There weren't any books or internet. And then she'd say, what was your experience, Nuria? And I'd have to get it on the nail before I'd move on. I don't know how she was with you, Salima, but she did that with me. Every month I got a new set. I didn't get to go on until I knew what was going on with that word. So I had to really feel the vibration of the word. But let's try that as an experiment. Again, some of you know the meaning, but see what happens when you listen to and feel the sound within. And we'll just do it 11 times aloud with the prefix Yah, meaning, oh divine, or oh dear, this quality of meaning, which I'll tell you in a minute. And then we'll say it just with a whisper, just with the word Ali. So it'll be like Ali. And then you'll just say it silently. And what I would like for you to do, watch where the sound is with the ah, and watch where the sound goes with the een, and don't forget the let that go on, and see what happens. And if you might think about this as well, there are these yogic postures that happen. I'm not going to make you sit a certain way, but also the way the breath goes or the direction of the eyes can affect the consciousness. So with eyes closed, or if you want to do it slightly eyes open, when you say the Aline, you want to direct your eyes closed but upward, as if you're looking out the top of your head into infinite space. Is that clear? Okay. So we're going to say, we're going to just do an 11, 11, 11 for time's sake, because I know that I promised to end this class at a certain time, and I'm going to do my very best. I know that when I'm at these camps and retreats, I do. Why can't I do it here? I can. And you will help me. Okay, let me get untangled here for just a minute. I'm untying the knots, but I'm learning. Okay, for 11, really, I'm going through all this trouble. Yeah. I lose track, though. I can get lost in the practice.
Yami.
The attunement's more subtle. We breathe in in a whisper, Aline, and out Aline. So again,
Oh,
Now, for the silent part, we'll breathe in and out a lean. Put your eyes up as if you're looking out through the top of your head. And put the tongue lightly at the roof of your mouth as you breathe in and out this sacred word. So maybe just one more quick word about your how your body feels, your mind, your emotions. Anyone want to offer something? A few words? Or how does the space feel different than it was before?
Calm. Complete.
Blossom.
Awesome or blossom?
Blossom. Blossom. Like a blossom.
Yeah.
Open. Lighter and open.
Lighter and open.
Right.
Right. What did you feel in your body as we did the practice? Anything? Elevated.
Yeah. The vibration carries up into the head and you really feel that. And it almost even felt like there were little particles and they start to open up and get more space between them.
Yeah. Rising above. Did you all have the feeling of kind of being lifted? You see, just a word. What it can do, the vibration, and also the yogic practice of the eyes and the tongue. You see why these yogis have practiced this way for thousands and thousands of years.
Nuria?
Yes, I mean,
when I was doing it, I felt uplifted, but at the same time, as I went, Alim, I could feel it going to my heart. Very much so. It was like it was an outward, but it was very inward, going right to my heart.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to blossom is very Lithuanian.
Yes. Our two Lithuanians here.
Half-breed
anyway. Yeah. So, go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking you were also mentioning, which was good for me, about the sound. And when I became more conscious of that, I think it relates also to what Raheem has shared.
It really teaches us how the body is an instrument and how we when we do those certain again postures or we can feel that vibration shift. You know, these are like these boards really, and when you look at Indian music, you know, they have the different boards and they're using vibration and the strings. Well, the strings are our vocal cords. And we're creating these vibrations in this instrument. So what does Aline mean? Aline means divine insight, divine knowledge, intuitive knowledge. So intuitive knowledge is different than concrete or tangible knowledge. It's something else than that. It also is this aspect of having certainty. Having certainty and being thoroughly informed, not just from our point of view, but from other point of views. Very beautiful. And in one way, everything's a gift. I think maybe it was our last class where it was like, thank you, God, for everything. It's all a gift. We forget that. And, you know, even I read a lot, you know, that of the Catholic saints, and you know, they always remind me, even in our suffering, it's like, what is the divine or God trying to teach me, even in suffering, you know, for physical ailments? What's the lesson? What are we to learn from that?
And sometimes you don't even have to know that. I mean, coming from that tradition,
yeah.
The saying that was always, you know, given us was, offer it up.
That's right.
So it's almost like even letting go of that knowledge of why this is happening,
right.
Or, you know, this is just letting it go to God.
Yeah. And I think being reminded of the suffering of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a little thing compared to what Jesus did for us, right? So it can also be interpreted to unite our mind with the mind of God. Unite our mind with the mind of God. I mean, just think, as we affirm that every day, every morning. May I unite my mind with the mind of God. I'm coming close to the end, and I am going to end, perhaps even a little early. There's more to this teaching, as I said. Even I have more here, but I want to give people remotely a chance to say a few words, and we'll do the practice one more time before we close. Again, Murshid says, the spiritual point of view is looking at a thing from two sides. It is like looking from both eyes to make a thing complete. Salima, please mute your microphone, dear. So looking with two eyes to make a thing complete, you know, I mean, think about that. I mean, first of all, I mean, this vision apparatus is pretty amazing. And I don't know if any of you in physiology or anatomy, I know in graduate school, they made me study the anatomy of the eye and how we perceive. So all the cones and the rods and how the image comes in, and it's the mirror and the mind turns it right side up. It comes in. It's all of that. It's like, okay. So anyway, you know, it's one of those things like, why am I learning this? Just like geometry. And then when you have to build a house, it's like, oh, that's why I had to learn geometry, right? Or why am I learning algebra? Then you write some computer yes. code, and it's like, oh, that's why I had to learn algebra. So it's always good to learn, you know. But when you think you know everything, you know, like a graduate student, then you question your professors. So. And I was thinking about this, looking with things with both eyes. Some of you know I did a little bit of consulting work at NASA, and that was one of the things. They were trying to get virtual reality, really, so they could make remote repairs. And so they were trying to create an environment using computers and the visioning process so that they really were perceiving three dimensions in space in a way that they hadn't done that. And part of that required stereo. Okay, have you ever gone to a 3D movie? I don't have to even talk about NASA, right?
Yeah.
You have to put those goggles on, and then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, it's happening. But that does something to the eyes, you know, where you can do that if you're studied enough with your vision. You can soften your vision, and you can make things appear that way even without the glasses. So that's a very, again, tangible view. But if we could see things, you know, it's like, where's Waldo? You don't find Waldo unless you're really relaxed, right? Or those highlighter books when we were kids, remember? It's like, find the bird, find the dog, you know, find the screwdriver or whatever. But when you relax is when you see it, right?
Yeah.
Well, what's that telling us? Again, don't get constricted, relax. Easier said than done.
Yeah.
That's why we're here, is to remind ourselves and to support each other in that process. And then Murshid says this, will you therefore be surprised if one said that there is no set belief in a for a Sufi?
In a what Sufi?
For a Sufi. So there's no set, like, I believe this way. We don't have that. Mercer didn't have that. He found a way to find agreement with everyone. You know, when he would meet a man of, or woman of philosophy, because he was really a champion for women, early part of the 1900s, until he passed his whole life, really. But anyway, he would ask them, you know, what is your belief, or what is your profession, or what is your, and he'd always learn from that. You know, there's that great story of him meeting Henry Ford, and they became great, great friends. In fact, Henry Ford sent him a car to Europe, and Mercer didn't know how to drive. And Mercer Hedayat, who was his son, would say, you know, notice that his father was leaving and going somewhere a certain day of every week. And he got very curious, and he insisted, you know, Papa, you have, or Abba, you have to take me with you. I have to know what you're doing. Well, he was going to learn, take driving lessons, learn how to drive the car. And there are these stories. I have them. I can share them with you. But he also had a driver. There was a student of his that became his driver. But then you also might find it very interesting to know. I know, Amina, you've done this research also. She's our historian in many, many ways. Safiya is our translator. She does a print, and Amina too. And, well, so many. Satari, you're all translating for us. Anyway, he had asked Henry Ford, what are you doing? You bring raw materials into the factory and you make something out of that. Well, what are you doing for your workers? So he convinced, and this is documented, I'm not making this up, he convinced, and I think they maybe still even have a program like this, we could probably verify easy enough, he convinced Henry Ford to create an educational program for the workers, not just about manufacturing, but so that they themselves could become better and better educated. Mm-hmm. So this is how, if we see things from someone's point of view and the capacity to make things happen, we can interject something into the atmosphere. I often say that in my case, I say it again and again and again and again, sometimes being very frustrated until someone else in the group decides it's their idea and they champion for it. Has that ever happened to you? Right? So, but that's okay. We don't need to own it. If other people own it, all the better. Stakeholders, right? So, but yes, he did this. He had this influence on very powerful and important people in the world, and benefited many from these conversations that he would open up with various people. And here, there's a picture of Mercer with the car in the archives. It's very sweet. To think that they had that good friendship. So again, will you therefore be surprised if one said that there is no set belief for a Sufi? In my office at the college, I had a picture of Jesus, of Buddha, of the Dalai Lama, of Gandhi, of Mother Teresa, you know, all kinds of, and probably Krishna, and there were all kinds of things. And the students would come in and they'd go, what do you believe in? And I'm like, all of it. And they would say, you mean we can do that? It's like, yeah, you can have it all, you know? But they really didn't, you know, people are raised where they have, this is it, and this is it. And they respect that. Their parents taught them that way. Their church taught them that way. That's the way to follow. But as soon as they realize, you know, things open up, then they really, that was like giving them great permission to be anything and everything and to learn from anything and everything. I was very transparent. I always feel transparency is your best protection. No one can say you're a kook if you're just outwardly a kook. We don't think it's kooky, but others might. You know? Yes. Would you be amazed if one said that Sufism is not a particular faith? It embraces all faith, all wisdom, all understanding. So Murshid says, unlearning is rising above one's set opinion, one's fixed idea, which makes one narrow. Progress must be gradual, and one must know to what extent one must progress. It doesn't all happen at once. It's subtle. And, you know, I would say that I've been on the path of my whole life. And there's still so much that I can't practice on a daily basis. You know, I have my character flaws and my personality, and I have to keep reminding myself through these teachings and keep practicing it and keep trying to do better, because we are born into certain causes and conditions. They form our character and our personality, and we have to try to work to refine. I choose to work to refine that. You know, I remember Mashita Vera. You know, sometimes I would travel with her or help her get dressed when we were at events together, and she'd just say to me, Maria, I just don't know why I can't be one of those sweet old ladies. I'm just so fiery. I just don't know if it's my red hair or the way I was raised, but I just can't control that fire. You've probably heard her say it, Selena. And I think often of that because, well, that apple didn't fall very far from the tree, you know. The first charge when something happens is the fire comes out, you know. The fire creates change. And for her, a woman of that age, being a spiritual teacher of that stature, it was required, perhaps, to have her place.
So it wasn't a flaw.
It's not a flaw, but she saw it as one, because she saw other people so much sweeter than her. But you know what? When she was around, people didn't bother to go to sleep. You know, they paid attention, and they listened, and they learned, and they weren't. It was a whole other ballgame when she was around. She was really a master. I remember the first time I went to India, of course, I called her before leaving, and then I called her when I returned. And she said, well, did you get eliminated or illuminated? What a great line. So pithy. You know, really stuck with it. I said, maybe a little bit of both, Murshida. Did you get illuminated or eliminated? Again, it's unlearning, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, go there and see what happens. Yeah. You will unlearn everything you think is good and proper and right and whatever. Everything changes. Go to any third world country, you'll see. So then Murshid goes on to say about this, that we make this progress gradually. But he says one must not be too frank about his two points of view, or he will offend every person he meets in life. Mm-hmm. Be accommodating. Mm-hmm. It's not always important to share it. Do you know what I mean? Why that silence is golden is really true. And Muhammad the Prophet said, a still tongue never strangled its owner.
The discernment again.
It's the discernment, and it's kind of knowing when, you know, I do that sometimes. I'll pause, you'll probably notice, I'll look up in the sky, and then I'll say something that seems so not right to say, but I say it for a reason, and sometimes it's a shock value or it's to make a point, but I try to check myself. I don't always. It's sometimes the passion of the moment again. So action, word, imagination, and feeling, these four things have a greater power than one can imagine. Even a meaningless action, an action which might seem to convey nothing, an automatic movement, even that has a certain result. So an example, someone who I consider a friend and a Sufi sister, we were at our Sufi retreats in the Ozarks, and you know, she felt that she could be honest with me, and I don't even remember what was going on at all. But she said, I kind of looked at her and then turned away. it was never about her, but it offended her. She thought I was snubbing her or making a judgment about her. It's like, I don't even remember that. And then she said, well, you were talking to somebody. And I thought, well, that's probably just, you know, I do that a lot. I scan the group, you know, like, I don't know if it's this element of paranoia, but it's like, I gotta know if any lions or tigers or bears are coming up on me. You know, I'm just always very open, you know, and kind of aware. And I probably did that, and she thought I was snubbing her. She was coming along the path. It was a meaningless action on my part, but it was interpreted in a different way by her. And it was good she cleared it up. And that's a good reason to also know that sometimes if those things happen, try to tell someone. She said, you mentioned it in a very gentle way. It wasn't confrontational. We could know, so of course not. I didn't feel, don't feel that way about you at all. Wouldn't, there was nothing meant by it. It was completely, you know, thoughtless in a way. Okay. So even a meaningless action, which is meant to convey nothing, can convey something. It can be an automatic movement, yet it can be misinterpreted. But Merchant says, the mystics of the ancient times had known the great power of movement. So if you think about this, there was always this idea of prostration or salutation or genuflection or bowing the head. These movements had some sort of, they convey something. They can convey humility or they can convey victory. You know, think about it, these gestures, right? In one of the teachings, it was very interesting. Merchant said that there were these cultures, these civilizations that required everyone to bow down before them. And he felt that this movement, constantly going down, was something that had that kind of energy to bring down a whole civilization when that movement is repeated again and again before a leader. It's very interesting when you think about it. You know, they do that in kinesiology. They do that, and then they muscle test you, and they do that, and they muscle test you. And, you know, when you do this, you're very strong. When you do that, it's very weak. So I think that might be in the Gathas, might be in moral culture. You could look it up, though, about movement. So Merchant says, movements have always been connected to sacred things. It's true. In ritual, we know that, but also sometimes it is required, just, you know, be respectful. And in that instance, it's a manner that maybe doesn't have as much meaning. But he says among the old Greeks, among the ancient Egyptians, among the Hindus of ancient times, among Buddhists, there's a science to movements. There was a power in the movement. And they knew that science, and they produced a certain effect. So an example of that may be in Buddhism, as part of your introductory practice. You're supposed to do prostrations, full prostrations on the ground, 100,000 times.
Right.
That's a lot. But it's also very good for our consciousness to pray. So we're praying with the whole body. And so we're going down and we're rising up again. We're going down and rising up again. You know how fit you get? Your arms, your abdomen. You want a good workout, start doing prostrations.
Right.
It's amazing. It's a way people keep fit. There's a whole lot of other things.
The whole yoga.
It is. And then I remember Rinpoche said, go to the temple where the Dalai Lama lived. Go to the temple and do this practice there. And he said, please don't ask me to do that. Because I said, I feel it is so pretentious as a Westerner to go up and do these prostrations with all the monks and the lay people that have been doing these practices since the beginning of their life. And here I am doing them. He said, no, you go, because when they see you doing it, you will also inspire and encourage them. So I had to confront that part of myself that was judgmental. And he saw, let me see things from another point of view. There's an example.
At one time, the Dalai Lama in his teachings talked about how to do prostrations.
Yep.
And he said, now when you get down there, and I, this is not exactly how he said it, this is what I heard. You don't just rest, you jump up like a fox. you know? That's right. Well, you know, you're on like you're whatever, 100 or something. It's like every time. It's, yeah. But it's that keeping this energy, it's yes. moving energy yeah. also.
That's mm-hmm. true. Yeah. That's true.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the movement, is, like the sound, mm-hmm. has vibration
yes.
in it. So the energy. It's all vibration.
It is vibration, and in fact, the visualization, you know, goes, you're bringing the energy down, making the frustration. And when you go out, you don't just stay there. You take your hands in the visualization I was given. You move your hands up and around, and as you're doing it, you're creating this beautiful merit field where everyone, the trees, the mountains, the water's clear, the fruit is ripe on the trees. There are beautiful things for every creature to be fulfilled with. And you're visualizing the whole universe in infinite grains of sand as an individual universe, and you're blessing every one of them. So it's a very complex, beautiful visualization, as well as saying the mantra, as well as doing the movement. So it's very, the Buddhists are very good at that because they tether the mind, they tether the it, you know, the sound, they tether the body, they kind of bring them all together.
And I know in the prayer of Sheikh Noor, because I've gotten to a point sometimes where I can't go all the way down.
Yes.
But he told his students to not just to go, put your hands out like as if you were down.
Yes.
And then
right.
go down. So yeah. that you are still using that same mudra, but not. Even if you can't get all the way to the floor as we get older.
Yeah, and just going. I see that people, they just touch to their knees and go down. That's good. You just use the concentration. I think it's complete. Is it complete for today? Have we done enough? Have we done enough, everybody? Do you feel full? Do you want to share anything? You can unmute for, but be mindful, watch others if you'd like to share something. I think we can close, start to close our circle.
Sukaina's raising her hand.
Sukaina, can you unmute and, so we can hear you?
I think it's Sukaina. Yeah.
I don't.
Ah. A practice that I've been given from a friend is just, there's an infinite number of perspectives. And so I took that, and then on my journey into the land of unknowing it came, and each one of them is correct, whether or not I agree with it, resonate with it, whatever feeling I have. But to bring it all in and accept it has been a great blessing and a great practice.
Thank you. Lovely, thank you. Anyone else?
Paul
been doing a lot.
Naria?
Raheem?
One thing that with you being my teacher has allowed me is to broaden my understanding and broaden my practices. And I was so intrigued by you talking about your office and what you have. And I just wanted to show you, because of you, you can see it above my dresser. That San Francis you gave me, the tree, the five remembrances with my grandmother months before she died to keep in mind. Yeah. Chungpa's mind training. But you... you're the one who was able to allow me to bring it all together.
I'm so happy.
Thank you. Thank you for putting up with my little voyage.
Very lovely. Thank you. Anyone else?
Sophia is raising her hand.
Sophia, yes?
Yes.
I want to just, for one moment, I want everyone to know your face. This is our dear person, and Raheem, you know, Raheem for many, many years was our the Hazara Nikon Facebook, who is the wizard behind the screen. And now Sophia has taken that over for us, and she is doing a great job and even expanding it into Twitter and a Sufi message. And we've gotten so many new people signing on to the mail list, and so many new members have come. She just started that in November. So I wanted to thank you very much for that. Bravo. Good job.
You're very welcome.
And thank you to Raheem for all those years of doing the work. Thank you. We love you and we appreciate you, all, both and all. So, Sophia?
Well, what I wanted to tell you is I'm babysitting a one-year-old boy. And last week I played classical music, the second part of the Seventh Symphony of Beethoven. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know it.
Yeah.
And he became very sad. So he came to me to get some comfort. And what I'm trying to say with this is, children teach me a lot to unlearn. And without words. So I'm very grateful. I'm also tutoring a few pupils, and they learn me to unlearn.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Okay.
Related to that, I was conveying to some people that, Parker, it's been very cold here this week, and I've just been I observe him, because they say you learn from nature, and a lot of the great yogis learn from observing animals, you know, in the jungle. And so what the first thing he does, now he's going to go down and listen. You're talking about me, I'll listen, Mom. So he the first thing he does his downward dog, his yogic pose. The next thing he does is upward, downward dog, then upward dog. Then he shakes all over, which I've had yogis in India tell me it's really good to do that. It's good that it cleanses the auric field. It's just to shake, shake, shake. And he does that. And then this week when it was so cold, he's not one that he usually wants to be with me, but he knew he needed the sunlight. But he timed it. He'd go out several times a day just for a little while, because he's a short coat, sit in the sun, you know, and basking in it, and be at the door, and he wanted to come back in. But he got his 20 to 30 minutes. And I thought, how, you know, just observing them, you learn so much. And you know that, and Perron, you send those wonderful pictures of the kitty in the sun, the cat, you know. Mm-hmm. So you observe your kitty, I'm sure, and notice that. So, well, let's close with the prayer. Khatum, again, some of you know it, some of you don't, but just listen to the words, because those words raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide are in this prayer. O thou, who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, O Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts, that we may hear thy voice, which constantly comes from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being. Thank
you everyone for being here. I think we're going to close our Zoom chat window for now. You know, I'm just an email or a phone call or text away. And until we meet again, inshallah, God willing, next month. And sending everyone my love and blowing kisses. Mm-hmm. And we'll close the window now and we'll continue here for just a bit. Love you all. Thank you for being here.